Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I am thrilled to be joined today by Ed Park, who is the author of the novels Personal Days and Same Bed, Different Dreams. He is a founding editor of The Believer and has worked in newspapers, book publishing, and academia. His writing appears in The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, Harper's, The Atlantic, and elsewhere. Born in Buffalo, which will play a part in the book we're discussing, right. He lives in Manhattan with his family. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you so much, Maris. I'm super psyched to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ah, what a pleasure. I love that a very low-key question runs through Same Bed, Different Dreams. And that question, of course, is what is history? And I'm not going to ask you to answer that right now. I think listeners will have to read the book. But what I wonder if you can talk about how fiction is the medium you use to answer such a question.
That's a great question. And I think that question, what is history, comes up early in the book. And I've been thinking, I don't know that this was conscious as I was writing, but I think the book is my answer, right? The book is kind of the answer to that question. Yeah. To talk about how fiction can be the medium with which to address that question and address the whole idea of history, I didn't start out to write a historical novel. And if this is a historical novel, I think it's a fairly unconventional one.
Yeah.
Usually when I start writing, I'm just that idea of like amusing myself and just trying to write a good sentence and try to keep whatever it is that I'm writing alive. And, you know, it was a very long process to write this book. And one thing that was evident early on was that it would deal in some way with Korean history, ideas of Korea and, Korean Americanness, whatever that meant. And so that was on my mind, but I didn't quite know how I would get there. And one thing that happened was that I read a book called Big Bang by a writer named David Bowman, who it was posthumously published, but I had really loved his first novel back in the 90s. It was called Let the Dog Drive. And I always kind of wondered what happened to him. He had a second novel and I think he did a biography of the Talking Heads, which I didn't read. And anyway, then the next thing I knew, I saw his obituary and then this book came out and I read it kind of just out of fondness for his earlier work, but it was really like a revelation. And, you know, I read a lot and I like a lot of books, but this is one of those examples of, you know, something about what he was doing just hit me with, you know, hit me full force. And I thought, he is writing about American pop culture, cultural history, political history, kind of mid-century through the 60s with a lot of like boldface names. And he made everything interesting. There wasn't really, I might be misremembering the book a little bit, but there's a very strong narrative voice, but there's no main character. And I kind of almost, you know, and I was in year 5 or 6, or I don't even know what year I was into writing my novel.
Oh my gosh.
And this was probably, you know, part of me was thinking I had reached some kind of impasse in my own book in Same Bed, Different Dreams. And I don't even want to tell you how many, that first draft is much, much longer than what you see here. It was just,
wow.
It was out of control. And, but Big Bang really like was so exciting to me that I kind of started writing, not really in that style, but just with that idea in mind that you could write history and have it be fiction and have it be interesting and have every episode be fascinating or gossipy, or, you know, it's just going to keep the reader turning the pages. But what I did was I took kind of the things about Korean history that I had always found fascinating, you know, for the past, let's say, 30 years, and even things before that, and just kind of wrote it in this tone of how am I going to get a reader who might not know any of this to be interested? So I was like writing it very in a way that appealed to me and I thought like the reader would enjoy. But I didn't know that this was going to be in the book, Same Bed, Different Dreams. So I just thought, I was inspired, let's keep going. And the eureka moment was figuring out, wait, this is actually the book that Echo, who is the Korean novelist who goes missing in Same Bed, Different Dreams. You know, I always knew he had some like unfinished masterpiece, but I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to put that into the book. Like, do you write a whole other book? But what I was writing, this kind of strange historical, you know, I would even just call it notes at that point. I realized that that was the novel that Echo was writing and that he never finished. So at that point, you know, there was still a lot of work to be done, but it was a way of bringing history into the structure of the novel in a way that felt good and organic to me.
Yeah. And so we're told about a novel that takes place in three different novels.
Yes.
And then you have written one as well. How do you manage it? Like, even physically, like how do you keep track of the storylines and when to break away for the next installment of the next storyline?
Yeah, it's such a, I mean, I don't know if you could see the look of terror on my face as you asked that, because it really was, you know, it's one thing to write a long book that goes linearly. It's another to be like, wait, there's going to be a book within the book that's kind of a second book. And then there's going to be like a third, you know, wavelength, which has characters from both of the other strands, but is also different in tone. And so it was, as you can imagine, a lot of typing up new kind of tables of contents, new like schemes, paper everywhere, paper like, you know, lining the walls. I probably do have a picture of, you know, at one point, kind of out of frustration, but also just to be able to visualize, like taping pages on the wall just to see like where things fit in. Because it is, as the book got bigger, like the architecture is really hard to keep in your mind. I guess the one thing I would say is that when I figured out that this kind of historical novel would be in the book, I could kind of figure out like the installments, right? And then mm-hmm. I would alternate that with I would alternate that with kind of my original book, which is kind of the Soon Sheen storyline, which in the book is, the subtitle is The Sins, S-I-N-S. And what I did was I took that original manuscript of many, many, many pages and just said to myself, pick the six chapters that you like the best. Like I really said, like, just what are the best chapters? Forget about continuity. Forget about, you know, oh, this nobody will know. Just like six chapters. And once I said that to myself, it was, I don't know what the metaphor is, but it was like, raise the Titanic or something. Like it lifted out from the sea of like verbiage. And I was like, okay, these are my tent poles, and I'm going to insert the historical stuff here. And then the third storyline is kind of a different matter, but that was the big kind of structural, God, I feel crazy as I talk about it, but that was the big structural thing that I managed to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I also love that, especially in Echo's part of the book,
yeah.
We are really told explicitly, no, not just in Echoes, throughout,
yeah.
That writing from different viewpoints at different times is helpful in understanding how the world works.
Yeah, I definitely. Once I broke out of the idea that it would all, just to backtrack, like the original version, I'll just tell you, most of it was just a straight first person Soon Sheen with some flashbacks, and some of the stuff that I didn't use, I think was fine, but it just didn't feel agile enough or capacious enough to get at what I kind of gradually understood with the themes of the book. So I always, I don't know, I mean, not to sound, well, whatever, not to sound pretentious, but you know, books like Ulysses and Pale Fire, kind of the usual suspects. But also there's a novel called The White Hotel by a writer named D.M. Thomas, a British writer who passed away this year. Just books that a night film by Marisha Pessel, you know, just books with a lot of parts. I think if there's like a pulse, if the writer is passionate, like I feel like he or she can just tell it in all these different modes, and you kind of get a more panoramic view of the story. And you know, it's not for everyone, and it's definitely not for every book. And I'm not saying like, oh, my next book will be that way. But even Personal Days, which is a relatively short book, it's like a third or a quarter of the size of this one. I think I wrote that the first part of that book is in the first person plural, but at around page 60, I was like, that's enough. You know, I get it. The reader's going to get it. And so I was like, let's do something radical. And it's the next part is kind of written as a report. And then as I like neared the, you know, 40 page mark, I was like, okay, enough of that. Let's do, the story had developed enough that I thought this kind of long, unpunctuated, almost like this piece of prose poetry would emerge in the last third. So it's kind of like, I guess at this point, it's part of my style, but
yeah.
It's something I like to read anyway as well. So in other books, that is.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And I love that you trust the reader to be okay with not knowing a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
But you also give the reader breadcrumbs. Like even,
right.
I think towards the end, one of the characters says, this all wraps up in the final book. Tell me about that trust though, because you had me the whole time. And,
oh, great.
It's quite a trick.
Breadcrumbs is a good way of putting it. I think every time you start a section, you know, that is different in structure or voice than the previous one. Like, you know, as a writer, I think there is this burst of freedom and energy. And I think that's a good thing. You're like, okay, now it's almost like here's a fresh canvas, like this is a triptych or whatever, and I'm putting on new marks on the page, on the canvas, but then, you know, I think once you get enough into that, whatever this new section is, then you have to really think, like, how does it relate? Like, in my head maybe I know it relates, but the reader's got to know, you know, after a couple pages, like, how does this, why am I reading this part, who are these people, etc. And I think one of the fun things actually was, you know, when a lot of the book was done, but still not completely finished, like realizing in some of these, especially in this kind of notorious third strand that I've been alluding to, which goes under the title 2333, kind of realizing like some of these minor characters could actually be characters from the other sections of the book. And so it was like, a bit like Easter eggs or, you know, cameos or, you know, walk-on roles, but it's there if readers want it. I think it also works if you don't catch on to it. But I have to say, like, you know, upon revising and editing, it always like made me smile to see like, oh, this is that character when she was like, you know, a teenager or whatever. And then you know, it almost like changes the sensation of time, because you're reading something later that actually happened decades earlier, and it just gives it a much more complex and I hope satisfying feel.
Yeah, let's keep talking about time.
Sure.
Because yeah, I love that in various parts of the book, there's the idea that, okay, if you have a VCR, you can suddenly tape television shows and your entire world opens up in a way that suddenly you have so much time.
Yeah.
And then there's something similar with the idea of how many movies you can see in a lifetime.
Yes, yeah.
And then, of course, the idea that war throws it completely off balance.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Part of what I'm finding interesting about this book, I was conscious of certain things as I was writing it, but then other things kind of sink in later. I mean, as much as it is about Korean things and Korean-American things and how Korean history and American history interlock, the character Soon Shin is like roughly my age, comes from Buffalo like I did. Father was a psychiatrist, like mine is. But it's also kind of a snapshot or a memory of the 80s, not to get too Stranger Things, but that's when, that's kind of when I came of age. And I feel like I remember the first VCR and just being like, wow, what does this mean? Like everything seemed, at the time it could seem like just a new machine, a new gadget, but it was actually quite profound. And in a way, especially kind of as we get into Dream 5, the last section of the book, I don't know, I feel very emotional actually talking about it now, but that's, the book is quite fictional in most respects, but a lot of those memories and impressions are almost like me trying to preserve that moment in time and that moment in my life. I hope other people, future generations, find it interesting, but it kind of felt important as I went on, and time and history became such a big part of the book.
Yeah, and so let's talk a little bit about KPG, which for me, in terms of the first thing I did when I opened the book, was I Googled what it was, and tried to keep that in mind as you expanded and made an entire new world about it.
Yeah. So the KPG is something I learned about, when I was in my 20s. I went to Columbia for my MFA, but I'm sure they still do it now, but you would also have to take at least one class outside the department. And they offered a modern Korean history class. And I just thought it was probably the most, because a lot of them were undergrads and stuff, non-writing people. But I was like taking notes. I was probably the best student there because it was all so fascinating to me. And anyway, one of the things that was mentioned was the Korean Provisional Government. So in 1919, Japan had colonized Korea in 1910. And, there was obviously some resentment building up. And in 1919, there was a big mass demonstration all across Korea. And at that point, as a reminder, Korea is just one peninsula. It's not cut up into North and South. So it's all across this country that's now a colony, a nonviolent protest on the Koreans' part, I should add. And a declaration of independence is formulated. And then soon after, this Korean Provisional Government, or the KPG, is established. And the headquarters are in Shanghai in China. I've never been to Shanghai, but you can actually go online and see pictures of the original headquarters and like these very like dapper looking Korean guys sort of at the place. But they name as their president Syngman Rhee, who at this point is in America. So he leaves Korea around the turn of the century, and he is a very interesting character. We can talk about him later, but he goes to all these schools on the East Coast. He lives in Hawaii, and he's a very flawed character. But one thing in those early days is he's always trying to get people to listen about what's going on in his homeland. And really nobody's listening to him, but the people in Korea No, he's like a legend. And so he is elected as a president, even though he's like thousands of miles away. So it's a very symbolic organization. And, you know, did they tried to change public opinion, and, you know, how much they succeeded is up for debate. But anyway, once I learned about that, just this idea of a government in exile was so fascinating to me. So anytime I would go like in a bookstore or a library and there's a book on Korean history, or even like early 20th century history, Asian history, I would look in the index to see if the KPG was mentioned, just looking for any kind of, you know, morsel. But so the version of it that's in my book is, you know, it has a basis in reality, but a lot of it is fiction. I quote unquote enlist a lot of real life figures and say that they are members of the Korean Provisional Government. I should add that they are in my book, but in reality, Marilyn Monroe, I do not, unless I'm...
Maxwell Perkins, not,
Maxwell
not
Perkins.
A member.
Yeah, exactly. Thomas Wolfe. So, but I did like this idea of anyone, even like Westerners who had some connection with Korea, like what if they were part of the KPG at some level? And that was really, you know, when we talked at the beginning, at the outset of, about kind of the historical aspect of the book, the dream, which are called dreams in the book, dream 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And that became kind of like the refrain. So I would have an anecdote about Jack London as a war reporter in 1904, and then all this stuff. And then the last line of that section would be Jack London was a member of the Korean Provisional Government. And it was just, I mean, it was fun, but it also just felt like a way to connect Korea with America. And like, you know, Jack London is still a famous writer, but I don't know that many people know of that he was in Korea, and he was a war correspondent. And he actually had a lot of kind of unkind things to say about Korea and Koreans, but you know, that's something that I had read decades ago and just stuck in my head and stuck in my craw. But I thought, wouldn't it be fun to put him in the book and to actually make him a member of the KPG somehow? So that's kind of how that element came to be.
And I love how many writers we get to see. One of the things that resonated with me particularly now is there's a point in one of the dreams where the writer Richard E. Kim tells Philip Roth that Korea is kind of like the Israel of Asia.
Yeah.
And that's a metaphor that rings true right
that's,
now.
Yeah. You know, so Kim, growing up, he was kind of, I mean, not even growing up, I think I was in college when I first learned of Richard E. Kim. But it's interesting, he, you know, he was an officer in the Korean War, and then eventually came to Iowa. And so he intersected with, you know, University of Iowa's famous writing program. And I think Roth had been teaching there. So he intersects with Philip Roth. And for a long time, he was like the only one. And Young Hill Kong had written, and I eventually learned about him. And Teresa Hakyung Cha is kind of this legendary writer, artist from the early 80s, who I think I learned about a little bit later. But Richard E. Kim, you know, resonated with me. And I'll just say this, in the book later, I think I kept this in the book, but Philip Roth mentions in Zuckerman Unbound, which I read a long, long, long time ago, I guess probably in college, but I remember thinking, why does Philip Roth have this bit of Korean trivia in the book? And then one of the characters in the book says to Zuckerman, I guess, that he's like a former quiz kid. So he's got all this trivia, and he mentions this Korean admiral. And of course it's misprinted or misspoken in the Roth, but it is this famous admiral named Lee Soon-shin, who is who is named, that's the name of the Korean restaurant in the beginning of my novel. Anyway, but so anyway, I love how like many, like 40 years later or more, I'm like, let's say 40 years later, no, 35 years later, I find this, that Kim and Roth actually knew each other, and Roth spoke very highly of his, of Kim's work. So that's just one of those things where if you stick around long enough, all the things that you remember, like kind of can work their way into a book. Yeah.
I love that. Let's talk a little bit about names in this book,
sure.
How they change, how they get westernized sometimes. Yeah. Homophones, and I guess also anagrams. I mean, I think about the idea of same bed, different dreams, it's like, yes, the letters are the same. Here we are.
Right.
Meaning.
The meaning shifts. That I'm so glad you asked that, because I mean, anyone who knows me, because I love wordplay. I mean, I think that's somehow seen as being unserious or too clever, but I do like 3 crossword puzzles a day. I love that. Or just walking down the street, like, you know, you see a sign, it's like, oh, that's an anagram for blah blah blah. How do I harness that though into this book so it's not just, you know, filigree? How is there a deeper meaning? And I guess this is actually, I think, I don't know if it's profound, but it's definitely something that has been true in my life. And that's, you know, I grew up in a household that, you know, my parents would speak a mix of Korean and English to me. And I can't really speak Korean. If I do, it's very halting, but I still understand a lot. And, you know, one of the fun things about this book is rendering Korean words into English and the anglicization of it. So Soon Sheen, his first name is Soon, his last name is Sheen. The typical way to spell, anglicize that Korean last name is Shin, like your shin bone. But Sheen actually had more, it was just a little more unique. It had a little more oomph. You can think of Charlie Sheen, of course, but there was also a Korean director, a Shin Sang-ok, who I think he was the one who was kidnapped by Kim Jong-il, he and his wife, who was an actress, and he like made them make these movies, and you can actually see some of them online. But he later, you know, they later were freed and they came to America, and he did like Beverly, like one of these like kiddie ninja movies, and he anglicized, his last name is Sheen. So, you know, that might seem like a small thing, but as somebody who, you know, I just read in English, I read everything in English. I can't read in any other language. Names are important to me. And, you know, on a very technical level, you want names to stand out to the reader, right? So they're easier to remember. So that was like one early example, but I think there are also, you know, not to give too much away, but there are actually major plot points in the book that hinge on either mishearings or alternate anglicizations. I will say one thing. I was thinking about this the other day. In the book, there's a company called Harmony Holdings, a somewhat enigmatic group. And what I associate Harmony to is the Korean word for grandmother, which is Halmoni. So you would spell it more like Halmoni, but I just have this memory, and I think I wrote about this many years ago in an unpublished essay. When my parents first came to America, they lived they rented a floor of a house run by kind of an older a German American woman. And I think years later, so that's where I was born. This is very like, it's on Dartmouth Avenue in Buffalo. And I think I might've put Dartmouth in the book. It's like a very kind of a small house. But years later, she wrote a letter to them and somehow, you know, just said something about being like my grandmother, and I think she wanted to write Halmony, but you know, she spelled it Harmony, and I just thought that was the best misspelling. I wouldn't even call it a misspelling, but whatever. That was many years ago, and as you can see, it has still stuck with me. But it actually becomes a major kind of a big thing in the book, if readers care to track how that word is used.
Yeah, and then I think we touched on this, but this book very much lends itself to rereading. And I even just to prepare myself for this interview, I went back a little bit and was like, oh my gosh.
What's going on here?
it's all there. It's all there.
Yeah.
And even just the idea of studying different texts and doing close reads.
Yeah.
And the importance of all of that.
Yeah, I would love people to read it more than once. I mean, it's a lot to ask. We're all quite busy. You know, I totally understand that. But it is kind of amazing. You know, I don't do a ton of rereading, but there are these books that I'll just go back to, even though I've read them 1,000 times. You know, and sometimes I just started teaching again. But, you know, when I was teaching more, you know, certain classes I would repeat. And so I'd have to read the book again. But there was something so enriching just as a reader, but also like validating, like, I liked this book the first time. And on my fifth read, it's like even better. So, you know, so it sounds a little immodest, but I did want the book to be something that, you know, maybe kind of like you're saying, you finish it and feel satisfied, but hopefully there are reasons to want to, you know, go back and if not read the whole thing, just like, you know, drill down into certain chapters and just kind of see what's there or hidden there.
I love that. And we didn't get to talk about hockey or Friday the 13th, but I think this is a good introduction. So before we go, can you just can you recommend some books for us, please? Even though there are plenty of books in your book that you can.
Yeah. I thought I would just mention two books. One is quite slim. Did I bring it out here? It's called Generations by Lucille Clifton. Oh, it's right here. It's a memoir that she wrote in the 70s. And she, you know, we all know Lucille Clifton as this great poet who people still read today. Somebody named Toni Morrison was her editor. And not just her editor, I think she wanted, I don't think Clifton would have written this book unless Toni Morrison was like, you should write this, you should write this book. And so it's so, I don't know what to compare it to. It makes me think a little bit of some of those early like thin Ondaatje books, like Coming Through Slaughter. Like it's written in this, I guess it's poets writing nonfiction and bringing their poetic talent to bear on it. There are these like repetitions and images. It's just a very potent work, and it's a, you know, Generations. It's about her family and you know, her parents, especially her father, and their kind of journey, you know, to get to where she was. And one reason I wanted to talk about this is because she was born in Buffalo. And, you know, she eventually left Buffalo, but I do think of her as one of the great Buffalonian writers. Actually, I was going to bring up a different book, but maybe I'll bring up another Buffalonian named, his name is Lawrence Block, and he's a well-known mystery writer, thriller writer. I've had a chance to get to know him a little bit over the years. One book that might have, he's, what I like is, you know, he's quite old now, but he's like self-publishing like crazy, and his old stuff, but also there's a memoir called A Writer Prepares that you've got to read. And it's really about how he got into the writing business in New York in the 60s, starting out as a working at the Scott Meredith Literary Agency and all the schemes and like, it's just really great. And so two favorite Buffalonian writers, Lawrence Block and Lucille Clifton.
I love that. Ed, thank you so much. Same Bed, Different Dreams, out now.
Thank you, Maris.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.